Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Schinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers and electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free and available when they're interested in listening to it. And we have a special show today, first made special because I'm sitting on a side street in Puerto Rico, San Juan, Puerto Rico, talking to Stephanie Ma in Cincinnati and Chris Olson, who's in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I won't even tell you who's in shorts and a T-shirt among us, but
we're in.
Anyway, today we have a great show. It's a potentially hot topic of law firm insourcing and outsourcing. Lawyers sign off on the completeness of electronic discovery productions, and everyone from the Sedona Conference white papers on project management to Judge Shindlin's Zubelake opinion, I think it was 4 or 5, look to the law firm for accountability for an e-discovery project. So where does the line end? Can a law firm do everything in a project? We have an interesting panel on this show, two technologists, one from a law firm and one from a technology vendor. And to be fair and provide complete disclosure, I'm also a technologist from Juranov, which is an IT vendor. Chris Olson's the CEO of Cricket Legal Technologies. He's had a 25-year career in legal technology, which includes positions with a variety of legal services vendors and also a senior position within an AmLaw 100 law firm. He's held senior positions, and his place in the IT legal community is easily recognized just by walking past his booth recently at the Legal Tech in New York, where everyone dropped by and knew Chris and said hi. So, Chris, thanks. Glad to have you on the show.
Yeah, glad to be here, Carl. Thanks.
And Stephanie Ma manages the litigation support services for the Cincinnati, Ohio law firm of Keating, Muthing, and Kleekamp, which we'll refer to as KMK, where she focuses on litigation document management services and e-discovery implementation. Primary responsibilities include database administration, project management, building and monitoring vendor relationships, and providing electronic document review and production deliverables deliverables during the discovery phase of litigation. As a member of the Information Technology Group working exclusively in litigation, Stephanie's role in KMK's e-discovery task force enabled her to participate in the firm's efforts to bridge the gap between counsel and IT by helping the firm's litigation attorneys educate clients about proactive, compliant, cost-effective e-discovery strategies and implementation. Prior to joining KRK in 2005, Ma worked for Jones Day and Robbins, Kaplan, Miller, and Ceresi, LLP. Stephanie's previously served on trial teams in several landmark litigations, including lead counsel for the asbestos litigation, the Penn litigation, and the Minnesota tobacco litigation, among others. In her work as an independent consultant, Ma consulted with several leading AmLaw 100 firms with respect to developing and implementing litigation technology best practices. Thank you both of us for joining us today. Then Chris, how did you get interested in electronic discovery?
Well, Carl, I've been in the business for 25 years in the litigation support business. I started out as a software developer and grew in position through sales and operations management. So I've really seen technology, come and go and evolve in the business. Certainly from paper coding to automated coding and scanning, and certainly now there's no escaping e-discovery. So I think my background, really leads me to be interested not only in e-discovery as it pertains to the needs of law firms, but certainly the underpinnings and technology associated with it as well.
Okay, and then Stephanie, how about yourself?
Well, first, again, thank you so much for having me, Carl. And I think first we should probably give the rest of Chris's illustrious background, because I'm sure it's far more interesting than mine. But thank you for having me. And that being said, I completely concur with Chris. I, too, although we kind of approached it from different standpoints, I became interested in e-discovery really back in about, in the very, very early 90s. a recent law school graduate who had an opportunity for my first very exciting temp job to do what was at the time a revolutionary task, which was using a coded document database as opposed to manually indexing our discovery documents. And the light bulb just kind of went on for me where I said, you know, this is really fascinating stuff. The power of being able to use a search engine to find keywords and in those days really objective information about a paper document in an automated fashion as opposed to manually sifting through these, you know, we had warehouses full of boxes, was just, you know, fascinating. And just as Chris said, I've seen the same sort of genesis of, you know, those early document databases to imaging systems, which I think were maybe the next big, I would say, kind of quasi-revolution, you know, where we had at least an image to use, which was a little more efficient, a little more cost-effective, but still a dead document, right, Chris? I mean, it was dead, static, you know, and now with most recently, you know, the e-discovery revolution, we have really a double-edged sword. We've got all of the best and the brightest as far as the characteristics of the data. It's live. We can search the metadata. You know, we've got these sophisticated search engines to do the filtering and processing. But at the same time, it poses just, you know, amazing financial and technical complexities with respect to how to make sense of all of this data in a uniform fashion where we, opposing counsel, you know, our clients can actually review and ultimately produce documents, you know, accurately. So, I mean, it's really been, again, just like with Chris, just sort of a natural, you know, a natural segue there, I think, for both of us, it sounds like.
Well, Stephanie, broadly speaking, let's sort of jump into the topic. When does it make sense for a law firm to insource business or own a process?
That's really an excellent question, and it's one that I think a lot of my colleagues and peers are, we're all asking ourselves actually probably on a daily basis these days. I think, you know, the natural answer that comes to mind is if we in the law firm have some core competency or a knowledge base where we have an existing, you know, set of resources to develop the process, I think that makes sense. And when I'm talking in those terms, I'm thinking of things like, for example, developing, you know, document review, everything from document review protocols to either selecting, you know, a partner such as Chris and his team to facilitate the review electronically, or doing it in-house using a hybrid model, you know, with contract attorneys, et cetera. Regardless, something, any kind of a system or technology, for example, that pertains to document reviews generally will work, just as an example, because we've been in the business, law firms, of managing discovery. You know, e-discovery is discovery. So we've been doing this for, you know, millions of years, and this is just a different platform to do that. Similarly, things like producing documents, you know, we've had to produce them, as we've both discussed, in paper format historically. So producing them electronically, whether it's in an image format or a load file format of some sort, is still a natural extension of our understanding of responsive versus privileged documents. And we, you know, we know what those obligations are, and we should be able to develop systems around that, I think, safely.
Look at your core competencies, really, and if you have them, go with them, and if not, maybe you
right.
Look outside.
And that's just kind of an, I don't know, that's...
It differs by firm, I guess.
Right, I agree. Yeah, and looking at, you know, a risk threshold as well. But I think, you know, you raised some interesting questions about, you know, how to kind of start that decision-making process. And I think starting with those types of areas might be more prudent and certainly more easily achievable than something like, let's say, you know, a very hot area right now is with respect to early case assessment technology, which I'm a huge fan of. But in order to implement that properly, you know, an organization, whether it's us, our law firm, or our client, needs to really clean up their own house first. In order to see the financial benefits from doing that. In other words, if we throw a bunch of garbage that's unstructured, unfiled data in there, even with the nicest Bentley of all tools, we're going to get garbage out of it. So I think those are the kinds of questions where, you know, to do that, we want to maybe tackle, you know, kind of the adage, don't boil the ocean, just start small, and start where, you know, start where we have some knowledge, hopefully.
And Chris, looking at it from the other perspective, when should a law firm look to, you know, other IT litigation service providers to partner with them and maybe outsource expertise?
Sure. Yeah, and having a little bit of a different background and experience than Stephanie, I guess I look at this and respond more from the service provider. Certainly, a process and a documented, repeatable process is very important to ensure and have confidence in the defensibility of your approach. Looking at some of the reasons that may cause a firm to outsource, even if a firm has that type of process implemented and has been successful in the use of it, you can still run into situations, i.e., insufficient skill sets in-house. You know, the people that truly understand the phases of e-discovery and the EDRM model and being able to see the big picture on a matter and work effectively with the case teams. Insufficient capacity. This is an issue that that vendors, everybody has to some degree. Now, if you're processing in-house, you may be able to handle, a certain amount of capacity over a certain amount of time or a certain amount of volume. But we all get faced at time to time with volumes that are a challenge, either volume-wise or complexity-wise. So that needs to be taken into consideration as well. Another thing that I've come across is the risk of a potential perception of conflict of interest with a law firm processing their client's data. So that's something that certainly, again, needs to be communicated, with the case teams. And get input, from the different groups involved. I think, one thing that is just very important in my experience is that the law firm needs to be successful, needs to have management buy-in and management support for implementing these types of processes, to educate the attorneys and the different groups and endorse the whole approach and the collaboration internally, and that also equates to budget. It takes budget to put the software, the hardware, the infrastructure in place to be successful. Processing deadlines and time frames is very important. Again, you may have the capabilities and the willingness, but we all know that you have to have the capacity and the wherewithal to get the job done on time. And I think, another important aspect of a law firm's in-housing versus outsourcing is the relationship between the legal group and IT. Those two groups really need to work together. I mean, legal obviously knows how to manage and offer, attorney services on a matter. IT understands applications, hardware, and they're the engine that gets it done. So very important for those two groups to work in concert, for in-house processing.
Yeah, Matt, sort of looking at it from the other direction about what some of the risks are, there's been a lot of discussion, and maybe not publicly, about IT litigation services vendors being accused by law firms of taking over e-discovery and practicing law or unauthorized practice of law. Or close to it, and conversely, there have been concerns that maybe IT vendors have been aiming back at law firms, and that they're unwisely perhaps taking ownership of the IT space in addition to practicing law. So you can look at it from both sides. Let's talk about the risk of both strategies. Chris, what can go wrong when an IT litigation support firm takes over legal responsibilities or gets too deep in that area?
Well, that's a great question, and it's certainly been a fuzzy area for a long time. I'll tell you that I saw a quote I found very amusing recently. It was in the signature block of a corporate client that said essentially that e-discovery starts out as the responsibility of those who don't understand technology and ends up the responsibility of those that don't understand the law. And
good one.
Perfect.
And I think that's what we're going to name the show.
Well, and I think that's
very apt.
A perception that's embraced by many. And it goes to the crux of your question, how do we bridge that gap at the onset of a matter and at the onset of a relationship between a law firm and a vendor? It's very important that the lines of responsibility are discussed and owned up front. And just as by way of an example or two, I believe that an experienced vendor will provide ideas, provide the opportunity to educate their client, brainstorm on strategies for, typically processing, document review, productions, and now with early case assessment, but really offering up their knowledge gained through the experience of the work that they've done. What vendors cannot do is offer services that are the responsibility of the case team. And, for mm-hmm. example, the creation of a potential PRIV term list or keyword lists. That's just something that if you're not an attorney and you're not on the case team understanding the strategy, you're just not certified or qualified to do. And I've been in situations where and this is fairly common, I believe, as a services provider, where clients will send a list that they've compiled and asking us to do the searches prior to delivering the documents to them for review. Even that is, it's risky. So what we always try to do first is advise that to make sure that they mm-hmm. understand what they're asking us to do. Mm-hmm. We'll go ahead and do the searches, but we're very, very diligent in documenting with screenshots, et cetera, because anybody can, have a typo entering a word, and we can't be responsible for that. So we would return that documentation following the search session for not only an audit trail for our client, but for approval that they agree with what we entered to perform, the search and the culling effort.
And I can see that getting even more complex now with tools like the area that I focus on, the concept searching area, where, mm-hmm. Driving the tools effectively requires, it's not just pushing a button, it's building a process up front, knowing where the tools can work and what their weaknesses are and, leveraging them. It's going to require communication, and PRIV searches is certainly one area.
Right.
But anyway. Stephanie, what can go wrong when lawyers take over IT responsibilities?
Well, I think, Chris has raised some exceptional points in answering his previous question, too. All of those considerations, about when to insource versus when to outsource are very crucial considerations. And I think that's something that we're able to see now as definitely a step in the right direction in terms of we're doing a lot more proactive e-discovery work, I believe, collaboratively, let's say. And we actually use that hybrid model of insourcing and outsourcing as we see fit and really for safety reason, quite honestly. And when I say safety reasons, in addition to the technical complexities and the obvious, kind of architecture, infrastructure problems that we could encounter without doing due diligence about what systems we're deploying, there's, for me, the most crucial consideration is, and I kind of use the analogy of, would we as, lawyers, support staff, members of the law firm, would we ever consider, let's say, going to a medical malpractice trial and saying, a bunch of doctors said that this guy did something wrong, but, we've not talked to the doctor, we've not interviewed the doctor, we've never met a single doctor, but we believe this to be the case. the use of experts to do something that really does require a sophisticated technical and oftentimes, you know, forensic engineering background for some of the work involved, we believe means that we need to be very careful about, again, what we do in-house versus what we do in an outsourced manner. So that's kind of, again, going back to, you know, Chris mentioned, you know, the potential risk of conflict of interest. I mean, those issues, again, even if something is done in a defensible, documented manner, just even having the presumption that there could potentially be spoliation, certainly, at least in my mind, when it comes to two areas, one being collection and the other being processing, those two areas are very risky within the EDRM model, I think, for law firms to really do properly and safely. And so, again, for cases where, you know, maybe in a Rule 26F meet and confer, if both sides concretely agree, again, going with what Chris was saying about the good communication that's required, if both sides agree that metadata is not necessary in this case, then maybe we will allow the self-collection or, you know, the firm to assist in something like that. But for all other cases, we try to maintain a fairly old school kind of hardcore approach and say, you know, you need to do this properly in a forensically sound manner, which means spending the money to engage, you know, a vendor such as Chris's firm that's a premier, you know, best of breed, qualified expert technologist to do this properly so that we don't risk having, you know, me, Stephanie Ma, do I want to be the witness, you know, at some point down the line? And that's, I mean, I think that's something that a lot of folks are overlooking right now, quite honestly. And I'm starting to see, you know, there needs to be maybe a little more exploration with that. But I still feel like we need to have a really clear risk threshold identified before we just undertake a project like that. But I think, you know, there are obvious infrastructure questions, too. I mean, you know, with the economy being what it is right now, I think, you know, it makes sense to say, is this a technology we can support for many years to come? And do we have the right, you know, talent base to be able to keep up with, you know, as Chris pointed out earlier, ASAPs? You know, our business is ASAP driven. You know, the nature of litigation and discovery, that's the nature of it. So if we're not able to scale up, how do we accomplish that? I think a lot of firms have been kind of captivated now by the idea that storage space is becoming cheaper. And because of that, I think, you know, firms think that they can kind of, you know, take on the mountain now, whereas before we could only take on, you know, a tiny little molehill. And,
sure.
You know, and I think there's a natural desire to do that, but I think we need to think, you know, there, again, are other security questions, you know. We've got a variety of different platforms and ways in which we manage sharing our external data, but it's extremely secure, multiple levels of authentication, and in order to do that, it takes a lot of time, again, and expertise and expense from within the firm to make sure it is secure, you know, because
not every firm goes to that level. I mean, that's
right,
where there's been
exactly.
A number of blogs. There was a recent blog about a hacking of firm sites where there's a lot of data there.
Right, exactly.
You know,
well, there sure is.
Are interested in finding data.
Right.
And it can further complicate document retention as well.
Exactly. Yeah, and I mean, and that's the thing is, what's our risk threshold there? Well, or our risk tolerance, rather, it's probably zero. I mean, we can't risk letting even one confidential or privileged document escape into cyberspace. So with that being there's no risk tolerance. So either we do it perfectly or we don't do it at all, which means the bar is really, really high with all of this, I think. I don't know. What do you guys think?
No, I mean, I totally agree.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, I don't know. So, and I think, I mean, to be honest, it's interesting because we're very fortunate. We've got great leadership here. And what, Chris, you said earlier about buy-in, I mean, from the upper management level, you know, our board of directors, our CIO, our litigation practice group leaders, really have been very visionary for a firm here, you know, in the Midwest to see, hey, we need to do these things properly. Let's develop an e-discovery task force. Let's try and do this right. Where that really doesn't always exist. So we actually have, you know, a department and a team dedicated to just these issues and these services. And, you know, I'm very fortunate personally to be able to work in this environment because that's, you know, not always been the case, as we both know, or as we all know, rather. So,
I'm sure there'll be a number of people listening to this podcast that are envious.
Well, it's true, though. I mean, that makes a big difference. And I think, you know, I think another big buzzword is, and something that we want to see is there an end-to-end solution, whether it's in-house or externally, that does everything, and, you know, in e-discovery? And I think that's just a panacea to believe that there is one perfect
right.
tool that can do all that. So again, going back to core competency, I mean, you know, Chris's firm is one that really did develop, you know, a lot of the early you know, e-discovery tools from a processing standpoint and a review standpoint. They're best of breed. So I think you want to think about, okay, what phase on the EDRM model are we looking at here, you know, and go and speak to those people who have those core strengths, whether it's in-house or, you know, your vendor. And really, you know, with people like Chris, we think of our vendors as our partners. I mean, I try not even to use the dirty word of vendor because really when you work closely, you know, as we've all done on these matters, you know, for large-scale litigation involving potentially a billion pages in a couple of our recent cases of discovery, you know, it's time intensive. You really need to think of each other as we're partners. We need each other, basically.
That's right.
You know, and I know it sounds very hokey, but without that mindset going into it, I think that's where a lot of the communication gets missed along the way, too.
Yeah, it's definitely a win-win situation when you work closely together, you know, for extended periods of time. You know, aside from cost advantages, just understanding each other's expectations, procedures, and being able to deliver, you know, increasingly more efficient and timely work product.
So the next question I have here is anyone truly able to own the entire process here? I mean, I've heard one of my best friends in the field, who's a prolific writer, blogger, editor of a major publication, as well as a national consultant, turn me down for a podcast because of the lack of expertise in one specific area. And this is someone who's as knowledgeable, if not more knowledgeable, than 99.9% of the experts in the field. The point is that no one knows everything in the field. It's just too big. So don't the most effective participants build better teams instead of trying to own the entire process? You know, don't we need each other to provide the best of our skill sets, or don't we? I mean, what's your sense?
Well,
let you take that. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think we've covered a lot of these points in terms of the process. Certainly, it can be advantageous to a firm to own the process internally, but even still, it's as Stephanie said, you know, you have ESI, you know, task groups and you know, representing the you know, the value and the desired input from different groups that have you know, a stake in a matter. Now, that, you know, that could certainly be the legal team, you know, a risk management team, an internal lit support team, IT. It could be an outsourced service provider that you use, and you know, experts that you use. So the answer to me clearly is no. There's no one stop shop. This whole process affects too many people, and not to mention the client. Right at the end of the day. So I think it's.
I completely
it's
agree.
A given
with you.
In this day and age, with the maturity of e-discovery, that it needs to involve you know, multiple groups, multiple skill sets, and core competencies.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, and I echo your sentiments with respect to, you know, especially your point about, you know, what is really best for the client, and at the end of the day, you know, Chris and I are both speaking to that as our number one interest ultimately. And
right.
You know, and that's where, you know, again, I think we would be doing a disservice to our clients, certainly from a legal standpoint, if we suggested that, you know, A, we have all the knowledge, we have all the answers, and B, we're going to do it all ourselves regardless of, you know, our compliance obligations with the, you know, rules of federal civil procedure, or now the state obligations that have come into effect as well. You know, so, I mean, I think from the standpoint that we say we will do what we do well for you, and when we are not able to do that, we will go outside and you know, get those tools and those resources and those strategists, as Chris said earlier. You know, a good e-discovery vendor is one that will provide kind of the pros and cons of different methods for, you know, doing your filtering and what will come out at the end of the day, and have you thought about it this way? And, you know, those are the kinds of relationships that we need to have. I think, you know, the biggest thing here too is, you know, we're, from the law firm standpoint, we have a kind of an atypical business model in a law firm in the sense that we don't have a formal project management model where, you know, every new case must go through, let's say, our task force or through IT or through whomever, the risk management group. You know, so it's really still, you know, as it should be, our legal teams drive our business. You know, our partners, our associates, our paralegals say, you know, we need to start managing this data. We're coming to you for help. And so we're a service industry. And, you know, it's different. So I think it's hard to implement kind of what we see on the outside in other, you know, private and publicly traded companies. It's a different business model. And I think that's something that we're definitely seeing now, you know, a need to kind of rein all that in with respect to trying to do it in a cost-effective manner for our clients.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I think that project management component is, again, people talk about it, but it's almost like glue that
right.
We haven't completely figured out how to make it work on all projects.
Right.
That brings
right.
people to different locations who have talent to work together and keep
mm-hmm.
track. And,
right.
You know,
these are all the soft things that we're talking about, and it's underrated. And as Chris said, you know, people don't always see the value in that, unfortunately.
No one is
absolutely
solve the problem.
All right.
But the good news is that gives me plenty more to talk about on podcasts.
That's good.
Well, you know, I think I probably nailed this project since I keep dropping this call here in Puerto Rico. It's an interesting experiment trying to do this, but I think it's been a neat show. I appreciate you guys putting up with trying this with the new technology. And
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Oh, very much.
I'm glad I got to meet Chris. That was the big bonus, too, for me. So.
Likewise, Stephanie.
And I got to apologize for not adding the last question on RFP process, but thought better. I think it's a whole other podcast because I think that goes right to the project management issue.
Yeah.
How do you get a team together, and is it divide and conquer, or are you really trying to build a better team working together? And, you know,
mm-hmm.
I'll save that for another day.
I just wanted to add, I think what came to my mind in terms of collaboration, I mean, everything we're talking about is working closer together, bringing in different skill sets and core competencies. And it isn't the ultimate goal. In my mind, once you find a couple vendors or whoever it is that you're working with and you trust them to continue to work with them to be able to manage fewer vendors and to have
mm-hmm. Yeah.
More, you know, to increase the quality of input
yep.
from that resource.
Okay.
All an RFP does is, in my mind, from a vendor, is to hold us at arm's length, essentially. And I'm painting
mm-hmm.
with a pretty broad brush here. Certainly,
I hear you.
You may want to use an RFP initially, but then you could track toward working toward, you know, longevity with your relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But gosh, I mean, for every one I find like that, I find 10 that just fire RFPs out to 10 or 20 or 30 vendors, and you never hear back from them again. It's a waste of time for everybody.
Yeah, it really is. And I think that's, we try, Chris, to do what you're suggesting, and that is to kind of go to my select arsenal of what I'll say preferred partners through the process of our initial due diligence, blah blah blah, you know, and
yes.
and be able to, like you say, you know, they start to learn our environment, they learn our workflows, they learn all those things, and they start to learn even some of our clients' infrastructures from the ESI standpoint.
Right,
which
right.
That's huge. That's huge.
1.3.
But you're right. I think most people don't do that right, Chris. And they, I always say out front, I say, you know, I don't want you to put together an official estimate until I know we've got the green light. You know, because it's a lot of time to do that. It really is.
Yeah.
You know, and it's an abuse of your team's time, quite honestly.
Well, it is.
You know?
And you're right, because with RFPs, the majority of the time, very little is known about the processing and end goal.
Yep,
you know,
that's exactly
how
right.
How do you price that? I mean, it's putting the cart before the horse.
Until I know number of custodians, file size, at least an estimate range, you know, I'm not going to even ask you to do that. You know what I mean? It's not fair to you ultimately. So.
That's right, Carl. You wanted to get a word in there, I think.
Yeah, one point.
Carl's falling into the ocean.
Yeah, no, I know. There's sharks going around right now. I was going to add one point. I remember being at a conference in New York in 2005, or there was another vendor there talking about the automotive industry and sort of total quality process, John Deming work, and how the suppliers working with the auto manufacturers were able to, over time, really sharply reduce the cost of cars. And it was only through collaboration and working together. And it wouldn't have gotten there through divide and conquer.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is a partnership. And I remember looking at the audience, no one got it.
Yeah.
But thanks for joining us for another show. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners. And hopefully we'll be able to have you do some more shows later this year. And for our listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast under extreme circumstances, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com for a complete list of our shows. However you choose to remember ESI Bytes, come back and learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Finneman from Journaut. Thanks again, and have a nice day.